Tonight on Exposé, the Israeli occupation forces' attack on Rafah was presented to the world as a successful rescue operation, when in reality it was a blatant attack on the last safe haven for Palestinian civilians in Gaza. Now, Zionist Israeli media accused their Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of lying to the world when he speaks about taking out Hamas or releasing all the hostages. And 97% of Arab respondents felt psychological stress during the war in Gaza, while 92% believe the Palestinian cause is an issue for all Arabs and not just the Palestinian people. Welcome to Exposé, the show that leaves no stone unturned. Ladies and gents, welcome to Exposé. Now, the Israeli occupation's military launched a wave of air raids and artillery fire in southern Gaza, forcing Palestinians to flee overcrowded Rafah in advance of a feared ground invasion that world leaders have already condemned. However, condemnation does not find its way in Western and Zionist media platforms. Rather, whitewashing Israeli entity crime seems to be the go-to story for most of those platforms. Let us hear from Fuad Itayim, our broadcast expert and writer at The Cradle, for more about it in Fake News Exposé. Now, the Israeli occupation forces carried out a massacre in Rafah last week as they portrayed it as a victorious rescue operation that matched their American Super Bowl ad theme. While the hostages were actually not rescued on the 12th of February, they were rescued on the 2nd of February. Now, Fuad, that sounds like a scene from a B-rated Hollywood movie, if I'm correct here.
Definitely.
What happened exactly?
Okay, so since the massacre in Rafah last week, which killed 100 people, over 100 people, including women and children. Mm-hmm. We've seen a lot of reports that the prisoners, the Israeli prisoners that they said were freed during that military operation, as they called it, were actually released earlier than they said.
Two men taken captive by Hamas on the 7th of October were rescued on Monday by Israeli military. During the early morning raid, Israel carried out airstrikes that the Hamas-run health ministry said killed around 100 people in the southern city of Rafah in Gaza. The two men, Luis Har and Fernando Marman, had been kidnapped in the kibbutz of Nir Yitzhak and had spent 128 days in captivity. But according to some social media users, Har and Marman were not freed during this assault on Monday, but were actually rescued by the Israel Defense Forces, or the IDF, more than a month ago. Some shared what they claim is a screenshot of an article in Haaretz, an Israeli newspaper, which says the two hostages were released in an operation by the IDF on the 2nd of February 2024. Others tweeted this screenshot of another alleged article appearing this time in the Times of Israel, which claims one of the hostages, Luis Har, was rescued in December 2023. Some believe this is proof Israel staged a fake hostage liberation as an excuse to attack the city of Rafah. We looked at the Haaretz website and we found the original article about the hostages released, and it does say the two men were released on the 12th of February, so the correct date. This means the screenshot that has been circulating online has been doctored. As for the second screenshot, which shows the Times of Israel article, well, we can check using a tool called Wayback Machine, which shows us how a web page has been modified over time.
So far, even Zionist media was saying that the operation might not have happened in February 12, actually in February 2, or in December, but they had then reneged on what they said. What was that about?
Listen, it's very possible that Haaretz went in and changed the date afterwards, because at the end of the day, we know that Israeli media is subject to strict military censorship laws. So if the army says they have to change something, they're going to have to change it. But there was actually a Mayadeen report that came out afterwards that said that these two prisoners, first of all, they were released. They were actually released on the 12th of February, but not in a heroic military operation like the Israelis said. These two captives were, according to the report, were actually being held not by Hamas, but by a Palestinian family in Rafah.
Wow.
And the story is that the Israelis agreed to a deal where they would pay a sum of money for these to the family for these prisoners.
So that might have been possibly what happened instead of what Israel said. What do you have more for us on that?
The next thing we have is this CBN report, which jumps directly into Israeli propaganda about Rafah. It's talking about how Hamas rules the city, how the city of Rafah is key to Hamas's survival. Mm-hmm. And it goes on to talk about, you know, these stories of Hamas diverting humanitarian aid, mm-hmm. having a stranglehold over aid. So
Israel's operation into Rafah has begun with airstrikes. Since it's on the Egyptian border, Prime Minister Netanyahu promised coordination with Egypt. For now, Hamas rules Rafah, a key city to its survival. Some analysts believe Hamas uses the area to keep a stranglehold on the humanitarian aid coming into Gaza, a major way to control the people of Gaza. Hamas uses more than a million Gazans who have fled to Rafah as human shields. NBC is reporting Israel is open to allowing Hamas mastermind Yahya Sinwar to go into exile in exchange for the release of all the hostages and the end of Hamas rule in the Gaza Strip.
Wow. So what happened right there?
Well, they're basically saying with zero evidence that Hamas has some kind of stranglehold over humanitarian aid in Rafah, and that this is how Hamas controls the population of Gaza and the Palestinian people. Mm-hmm. Actually, the other day it was reported that even U.S. intelligence believes there's no evidence for any such thing. Mm-hmm. There's no evidence, even U.S. intelligence said it, there's no evidence that Hamas diverts humanitarian aid, has a stranglehold on it in any way, mm-hmm. or uses it for its own benefit. Mm-hmm.
That seems weird enough.
So the next thing we have is a CBS reporter sitting down for an interview with what she says is a Hamas commander in the occupied West Bank. Mm-hmm. Of course, Hamas's presence in the occupied West Bank is used by Western media to justify more violence there.
Support for Hamas has soared from 14 to 42% since October 7th, according to a recent poll. We met a Hamas commander at an undisclosed location in the West Bank.
Are you a wanted man?
I am, indeed.
Calling himself Abu Abed, he joined 9 years ago when he was just 16. Almost half that time was spent in jail. Now, he is a Hamas recruiter.
Are you seeing more young people joining Hamas here in the West Bank since October 7th?
For sure. All the Palestinian people are standing by Hamas. I give the fighters guidance. When Israeli forces enter, I tell them what to do and how to open fire.
So far, we're supposed to believe that Deborah Pata actually met with a Hamas reporter in the West Bank. Is that supposedly true?
Well, as we can tell from the first sentence, the accent sounds entirely fake. Mm-hmm. Anyone who speaks Arabic will know that. And we also know from the past, especially the last few months, mm-hmm. is that Israel regularly uses crisis actors and impersonators mm-hmm. when they want to portray evidence for something that they don't have.
It is true.
That's not to say that there isn't Hamas in the West Bank. There is Hamas in the West Bank. There's Palestinian Islamic Jihad. There's mm-hmm. Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade. There are many, many affiliates of the Gaza resistance in the West Bank. Mm-hmm. But they don't look like this, and mm-hmm. they don't sound like this. And, of course, they're too busy resisting the occupation to sit down with a news team of this kind.
Definitely. I second that. But I want to thank you very much for your analysis with
thank
us,
Fuad. Thank you so
Fuad,
much for having me.
Today for being with us. Ladies and gents, let's move to Mainstream Media Exposé. When we or any other media platform says that the Israeli regime represented by its Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu lies about their genocide in Gaza, about killing Hamas leaders in Gaza, or about saving their hostages, we don't say it out of spite. We simply repeat what the leaders of the Israeli regime themselves are saying. With us is Ms. Julia Qasim, our mainstream media expert, to tell us more about this. Thank you very much for being with us. Julia, what do you have for us today?
Thank you, Marwa. Hello. Well, indeed, the Zionist media has been all over the place mm-hmm. accusing the Zionist PM Benjamin Netanyahu mm-hmm. of lying to the Israeli public, mm-hmm. the Israeli occupation public, and the world when he speaks about talking about Hamas, taking them out, or releasing all the hostages, which everybody knows at this point is mm-hmm. not true. The Zionist Jerusalem Post, for one, quoted former IOF Deputy Chief Yair Golan, saying that when Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu tells the Israeli entity public that it is possible to kill entire Hamas leadership and to save all the Israeli hostages at all time, he's lying. Mm-hmm. So speaking from Reichman University, Golan said that Netanyahu's cabinet must first return the hostages, which is necessitated by stopping the aggression on Gaza. Only later can they hope to reach Hamas, with the key being preventing Hamas from retaining control over Gaza. Mm-hmm. But of course, this is necessitated by the ceasefire that the Zionist entity has rejected 3 times. So Golan in the piece also even accused Netanyahu's policy of weakening the Palestinian Authority and stabilizing Hamas in 2009 as being one of the key sources leading to the October 7th Israeli entity failure to stop Hamas's operation.
So now he's pinning what happened in October 7th on the Benjamin Netanyahu government to begin with.
Right, and also going full circle in this narrative that he inadvertently propped up Hamas's power, which is a false narrative that you hear all the time. But as the continuous series of whitewashing the Zionist crimes against the Palestinian people goes on, the Wall Street Journal published an opinion piece written by none other than the Zionist entity president himself, Isaac Herzog.
Wow.
It's entitled "The Case Against Israel Rests on Lies." So it claims that South Africa grossly distorted in its presentation a quote by Herzog himself to the ICJ in its ongoing investigation of the Israeli genocide. So in this piece, Herzog was clearly frustrated because South Africa was very tentative to his words, taken from a news conference on October 12th, just 5 days after the Al-Aqsa flood operation began. The quote, which included a line that, quote, "the entire nation out there that is responsible," unquote, referring to the Palestinians. Herzog did not like the fact that his own words condemn him and basically are evidence that of his genocidal intent, because, of course, they justified the killing of Palestinian civilians.
Mm-hmm. And that quote was used against the Zionist Israeli entity in the ICJ, wasn't it?
South Africa used what Herzog described as a misconstrued quote at The Hague to prove Zionist Israel's intent to commit genocide and thus invoke a jurisdiction of the court.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So then in the same article, the Wall Street Journal publishes a video of the Zionist Israeli ambassador to the UN, Gilad Erdan, justifying his regime's genocide in Gaza. So let's hear what he had to say in the video.
Well, Erdogan usually has a lot to say.
How can one call for a ceasefire and at the same time claim to seek a solution to the conflict? After all, anyone who supports a ceasefire basically supports Hamas' continued reign of terror in Gaza.
What was he talking about?
So you see, Marwa, the Zionist Israeli ambassador to the UN openly claimed that anyone who asks for a ceasefire in Gaza basically supports what Erdogan called Hamas' continued reign of terror in Gaza.
Mm-hmm.
A video published to support an opinion piece by the Israeli head of state maintaining that accusations of genocide against the Israeli regime are false.
Mm-hmm. So he's basically saying that if anyone says, oh, look, Israel is bombing civilians, they should stop, actually supports what he said, violence and terrorism. I think that's like literally what the definition of playing victim is that we have always seen the Zionist entity play when it comes to something that is not against its interests, doesn't it?
Exactly, and just invokes this ad hominem, everything that is criticism against their genocide is Hamas.
Mm-hmm. I want to thank you very much, Ms. Julia Qasim, for being with us to talk more about the what the mainstream media has been telling us for the past week, especially about Rafah and about the horrors that the Israeli entity has been putting against the people in Gaza. Now, ladies and gents, let's move on to social media expose. Now, social media platforms have been the perfect place to expose the Zionist-Israeli genocidal intentions towards Palestinians and the Western regime's false claims of securing human rights and freedom of expression. Here is our own social media expert, Ms. Sima Itayim, who is also an editor at The Cradle. Sima, where has that train, if you will, of Western faux freedom of speech stopped this week?
Thanks for having me, Marwa. So the train has stopped at the Tech Transparency Project station.
Mm-hmm.
Tech Transparency Project is an information and research hub that seeks to hold big tech accountable.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, they've published a few days ago, on February 14, an investigation, what they claim to be an investigation. They are bothered that X is allowing freedom of speech for certain individuals and entities in West Asia.
Wow.
So Tech Transparency Project, who is, by the way, funded by openly Zionist entities and individuals, including David Magerman, Open Society Foundations, which we all know, Craig Newmark, Philanthropies, Bohemian Foundation, and Omidyar Network, found that Elon Musk's X, formerly Twitter, appears to be selling premium services to individuals, groups, and countries that are deemed to be a threat to the U.S. national security.
Oh, the horror.
Right. So TTP, Tech Transparency Project, pointed out more than a dozen X accounts belonging to U.S.-sanctioned entities that had a blue check mark. Mm-hmm. Now, the blue check mark requires the purchase of a premium subscription. Along with the check marks, which grant legitimacy, X promises a variety of perks for premium accounts, like being able to post longer text than videos and greater visibility for certain posts. So some of the accounts that TTP was irritated by included Lebanese Hezbollah officials and media, Ansar Allah-affiliated media, and Iranian media, of course, including Press TV.
Well, I would like to remind our viewers that Press TV is specially designated national subject to U.S.-imposed Iran sanctions for 2018 executive order and secondary sanctions because they rule the world, don't they?
Yeah.
According to what's known as the OFAC's database. Now, the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcast, also the IRIB, is also a specially designated national subject to U.S. People need to know this. About what the U.S. is doing. It's under a U.S. sanction that says Iran Threat Reduction and Syria Human Rights Act of 2012 and a secondary action. So the CIA expects the X platform to abide by the CIA's own illegal sanctions now?
Pretty much. And a lot of people have been triggered by this, not just TTP. This rage against the Elon Musk machine, which we've seen for several reasons in recent months. So this brought about some posts on X, like that of this account, Pete Quiley, at PQ Politics, who attempted to kickstart some kind of campaign with hashtags that were never picked up to become visible, let alone trending even.
Well, that's
Hashtag Elon Musk is a national security threat, and hashtag Elon Musk is a traitor.
I'm surprised that didn't pick up.
Right. So he's a national security threat for allowing national security threats to have premium features on X,
I guess. To express their thought.
Yes. Another tweet by Spyro's Ghost with an ironic handle, at anti-toxic people, claimed that terrorists are paying for checkmarks on X, as a report shows that Elon Musk's X has accepted payments for subscriptions from entities barred from doing business in the United States, a potential violation of sanctions.
A violation of sanctions, but it's not a violation of an entire human rights law and human rights principles to bomb indiscriminately people all over the world. But if you have those same people who are being bombed having a voice, it becomes so much triggering, doesn't
it? Exactly. And it's, you know, state media is only a problem when it depends what state that is, according to them. So,
Seema, it's always a pleasure to have you with us to comment on what's happening on social media. Thank you very much for your time and your contribution to Exposé. Now, ladies and gents, stay with us. We will go now to Figures Exposé. Now, a new poll shows that Zionist Israel's war in Gaza is taking a heavy mental toll on people across West Asia and North Africa. The Qatar-based Arab Center for Research and Policy Studies announced the results of the survey of 8,000 men and women from 16 Arab countries carried out from December 12, 2023 to January 5, 2024. Now, a staggering 97% of respondents say they felt psychological stress during this war on Gaza, with 84% of them reporting experiencing this to a great degree. Now, almost 4 in 5 said they follow news about the brutal campaign every day or maybe several times a week. Now, a majority of respondents said that Arab governments should suspend ties of normalization of relations with the Israelis as the top of second most important measure to stop the war. The survey also found that 92% believe the Palestinian cause is an issue for all Arabs, and not just the Palestinian people, up from 70% from 2022. The same poll also found that 69% of Arabs stand with the people of Gaza and the Palestinian resistance, Hamas. Now, Now, let us move on to the most notable expose voices for this week. Now, all eyes were on Rafah last week, as they are this week too, after the February 12 massacre committed by Zionist Israel. One notable video on Instagram by the Palestinian youth movement with 513,000 followers base posted a video saying that the U.S.-backed Zionist genocide on Gaza has reached a new urgent stage with nowhere further south for Palestinians to evacuate. Here's the Palestinian youth movement's voice.
All eyes on Rafah. At about 3 a.m. Gaza local time, the genocidal Israeli regime began its strikes on Rafah, on land, air, and sea. Over 100 martyrs and over 250 injured have been reported in the U.S.-funded Israeli strikes, targeting homes and mosques where many were sheltering. Rafah now houses about 1.4 million, which whom are crowded into displacement tents and apartment buildings, have nowhere else to go. With their backs against the closed Egyptian border, the Israelis have begun their merciless bombing of civilians. According to the local Kuwait hospital, in the span of 1 hour, 100-plus civilians have been confirmed killed, most of them children, and 250-plus injured, numbers that have likely increased. This is all after Netanyahu, who rejected a peace deal for ceasefire, claiming that they will continue until total victory. Since the start of Israel's murderous campaign, which has resulted in over 28,000 Palestinian martyrs, total victory has always meant ethnic cleansing and erasure of the Palestinian people. We call on the U.S. and its Western allies to stop arming Israel and for an immediate and permanent ceasefire.
Now, another voice on TikTok that became an eye-opening account when it comes to the Zionist Israeli genocide on Gaza is Frederick Joseph. In his video, Frederick says that the Israeli entity is gaslighting the world when it comes to Rafah. Here is Frederick's voice.
So as I record this, Israel is in the midst of absolutely decimating Rafah. And for those of you who are not familiar with Rafah, Rafah is in Gaza. And it is one of the safe zones, the quote-unquote safe zones, that Israel told Palestinians to flee to as they were bombing other areas. Now they are bombing the area that they told people to go to. And because they told everyone to go there, Rafah has become the most densely populated place on the entire planet. Like literally, that's not like hyperbolic. It is the most densely populated place in the world. And they are currently bombing it. And you know, as I've brought this point up and talked about, you know, what Israel is doing, and you know, for months and months now.
Ladies and gents, with that, we conclude our expose for tonight. Stay tuned for more eye-opening investigations on Expose. The truth is just a revelation away.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
The limelight.
After more than 4 months of the Zionist regime's brutal onslaught against the besieged Palestinian people, the world must ensure Tel Aviv's legal, economic, and political isolation. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Middle East Eye wrote, since the Zionist regime's genocidal onslaught against the Gaza Strip began last October, millions of people around the world have been experiencing a kind of paralysis. This is not necessarily an absolute paralysis. People are still able to engage in activities such as protest aimed at ending the genocide. They're asking fundamental questions about everything they thought they knew or took for granted about their states, governments, ideologies, media, educational systems, and international institutions. We do not suffer from lack of words to describe the realities of genocide, global imperialism, and the Israeli regime's settler colonial brutality. Such analyses are plentiful, written by scholars, journalists, and activists in Palestine and beyond. South Africa's case at the International Court of Justice is an excellent example. We also do not suffer from an absence of actions that are capable of truly challenging status quo power relations. Economic and political disruption is critical to forcing change, and we have seen many activist groups bravely engaging in such actions in the US, UK, Canada, and elsewhere. Indeed, the aforementioned paralysis does not disable our ability to describe the genocide and take action against it. Rather, the entrenchment and dominance of political, economic, social, legal, and cultural institutions stops the majority of people from taking the next step to radically transform these institutions. The task seems immeasurable, the risks high, and the desired outcome not at all guaranteed. But if people are truly going to take the next step and create consequences for the Zionist settler colonialism, then the boycott, divestment, and sanctions BDS movement must be adopted by institutions worldwide. Two key reasons underlie this state of paralysis: the idea that the Palestinian cause is a lost one, and the notion that an alternative world is too risky a proposition given all the uncertainty this would entail. Palestine may be a losing cause at the moment, but it is not a lost cause. Giving up on the Palestinian struggle is nothing short of giving up on the decolonial project or the aspiration to usher in a world that no longer operates on global imperialist structures and where all people can live a dignified, sovereign, and free life. If Palestinians are not free, then the Euro-American imperial and colonial project continues. That project has only one goal: to generate wealth and power for Euro-American empires. So long as this project continues, the large majority of peoples in the global south, along with indigenous communities and exploited peoples across the global north, will not be free. The path towards an alternative decolonial world will always carry a degree of uncertainty and risk, but this risk is worth it, and the Palestinian case helps explain why. The struggle for Palestine is worth the risk because the current path poses an unacceptable certainty: genocide. If we remain on this path, the genocide of the Palestinian people will continue until only a small fraction of those living between the river and the sea are Palestinian. They will become the oppressed minority, forced to live under exclusive Israeli Jewish sovereignty. This type of genocidal project will not stop with the Palestinian people. The Zionist regime's current actions are sending a clear message to empires that settler colonialism is still possible in the 21st century and that imperial outposts in any region of the world can serve imperial interest, thus ensuring the continuation of Euro-American colonial violence. There are consequences to genocide. People do not just forget about it and move on. Millions of people around the world now believe that this imperial world order understands only the language of force. It is impossible to predict where this might lead, but another world war is a real possibility. At some point, the peoples brutalized by US-led Western imperialism will find a release valve on a mass scale. There is no greater risk than the path we are currently treading, that of war and genocide. We need an alternative, and while that route is uncertain, we are not without a compass. There are many excellent alternative forms of social and political organization that we can learn from colonized people and regions, both historically and in the present, ones that emphasize collective well-being, participatory democracy, respect for all cultural groups living in harmony with nature, and embracing a multitude of identities. There is a better way forward. Let this be a moment to shed the state of paralysis and commit ourselves to a long-term struggle for Palestinian decolonial liberation through BDS, that is, boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement against the fabricated regime of Israel. The legal, economic, and political isolation for the child killer regime of Israel is the only viable alternative to genocide and war.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio, in which we try to ask and answer some of the questions related to the Islamic laws based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before we embark on our episode, let's take a listen to a short biography. A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtaza Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Well, we're going to talk about some of the jurisprudential laws around the issue of travelers based on the fatwas of Ayatollah Khamenei. Well, Sheikh Javid, there is a difference of opinion among the residents of an area concerning the Sharia distance. Some believe that the criterion is the walls of the area's last connected houses, right?
Yes.
Some others believe that the distance should be calculated from the factories and scattered townships, some of which are like industrial towns, sure, or townships, which are located beyond the city's houses. So the question is, where does a city really end?
That's a good question. Well, as we discussed in one of the previous episodes, we did say that things largely depend on the idea or on the opinion of the people themselves, the orf or the custom. I would like to actually read this very word of the of His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei in his Ajwibatul Istifta'at, where he says that the determination of a city's end depends on the common view. Thus, if the factories and scattered townships are not considered as part of the city, according to the common view, the distance should be calculated from the last houses of the city. So this is the answer given by His Eminence. We see and we do know that there are some very sprawling cities, the factories are scattered, townships small, you know, even there are, you know, buildings you can see in big cities everywhere around the city. So his opinion, as I read out, is based on the view of custom. Generally speaking, it is the houses, the last connected houses that are considered to be the end of the city, not those factories or let's say farms, dairy farms, you can say that are, that maybe you can see them in the out of the city's skirt, outskirt.
I see. Shastri, does the obligation of saying shortened prayer by a traveler apply to all the obligatory prayers, or is it limited to some of them only? And what about the recommended prayers, by the way?
Well, we do know that the recommended prayers are not shortened because they consist of two units, two rak'ah.
Usually, rak'ah. Yes.
And you cannot shorten two units and make
shorter
it,
than that.
Yeah, and make it one. Okay.
Yes.
So, and also we have the Maghrib prayer, which consists of three units.
Mm-hmm.
Again, Maghrib prayer cannot be divided into two and shortened. It cannot be.
Mm-hmm.
So we have actually three prayers, the Isha prayer, and then the Maghrib and Dhuhr and afternoon prayer. The
yes.
Dhuhr and Asr prayers.
Yeah, the
these are the prayers prayer. Which consist of four rak'ahs, and of course these prayers, which are obligatory,
mm-hmm.
are shortened into two rak'ahs, and they are performed as qasr.
Mm-hmm, I see. Okay, thank you very much. Let's take a short break and then we'll be back to continue our program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Don't go away.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, ya Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah. Oh Allah, don't let me go astray, cause I need you.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio, with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javed, our guest speaker. We're still talking about the travelers' laws or Islamic laws, or some of the jurisprudential laws related to the travelers based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Sheikh Javed, what's Ayatollah Khamenei's opinion concerning large cities or megacities with respect to the conditions of the intention of making them your hometown or watan, of staying there for 10 days, for example?
Yes. I should say that it makes no difference whether the city is large or small.
Mm-hmm.
When you intend to stay in a city for over 1 year, or let's say for as many years as you wish, that city becomes your actually hometown.
Mm-hmm.
And the rules regarding watan or hometown are applicable to you or to that city. And therefore, if you decide to stay in a city, whether it is small or large, for, let's say, for 1 year, that city becomes like it becomes your hometown.
Mm.
Although, according to His Eminence, if someone stays in a city for 10 years,
mm-hmm.
that definitely becomes his hometown. But okay, if someone stays in a city for 1 year and then continues to stay, that city becomes his hometown. Even if he has not stayed there for 1 year, but he intends, seriously, he decides to stay there for 1 year, that city becomes his hometown, and therefore he should follow the rules of a hometown, the rules which are applicable to a hometown.
So how long should one individual reside in a town to be considered for him as a hometown?
Hometown. One year is enough.
1 year continuously?
Of course. Yeah, 1 year.
Like
okay,
if he travels in the middle,
no,
in the meantime.
If you travel for 1 day or 2 days, again, in common view, His Eminence says that in common view, you are still considered a resident of that city.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Yes.
You are a resident of that city. You may go out, do your, for example, maybe your regular activities. Maybe you go out to your workplace. Your workplace is a bit far from the city. So you come back and go, so you are frequenting. But you're, at the end of the day, you are considered to be a resident of that city. You have to follow the rules of Watan, as stated by His Eminence.
Because I've heard it's about 6 months, not 1 year, is it?
According to my understanding of His Ajwabatul Istifta,
it's 1 year.
One year is, of course, definitely considered. But you know, the opinion in this regard among the religious authorities is a kind
different?
Of different, yeah. Some scholars, as far as I know, Grand Ayatollah Sistani is of the view that, okay, you have to stay or reside in a city for at least 15 months in order for that city to be your considered to be your
15
Watan.
Months?
15 months, yes.
I see. Okay, 1 year and 3 months.
Yes, sure.
I see. Okay, let me ask you one last question, Sheikh. What are the conditions for the four rak'ah prayers to become obligatorily shortened on the traveler?
Yeah, this is a question which, of course, needs a lot of some details, which I have to provide for our audience. There are as many as 8 conditions which must be fulfilled in order for the prayer to be shortened. Okay, and the prayer definitely, as you rightly mentioned, obligatorily becomes short. We are not choosing to shorten our prayers.
Yes.
Of course, it becomes mandatory for us to shorten our prayers. The first condition.
Would you mention the first one, and then inshallah we'll leave it up to the next episode.
Okay, that's good. So the first condition is that the traveled distance should be at least 8 continuous farsakh. Okay, 8 farsakh. And of course, we do know that 8 farsakh is equal to about 5.5 kilometers. And of course, the traveler should cover a distance of 8 farsakh. Now, 8, you multiply it by 5.5. It is some around
45 kilometers.
Yeah, 45 kilometers. So that is the minimum distance which must be covered by a traveler in order for him to shorten his prayers or even break his fast.
Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh Javed. I promise our dear audience actually to follow up our upcoming episodes to hear the rest of the conditions for. A prayer to become obligatory shortened for the four rak'ah prayers, in fact, on a traveler. Thank you very much for listening to us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Rahmanun Rahimun Mannanun Kareemun Salamun Aleemun Maljaa ilaha illahum Ghaffarun Jameelun Wahhabun Latifun Tawwabun Samiun Basir ilaha illahum وحيد قدير محيي مميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Israeli forces kill nearly 80 Palestinians waiting for food aid in Gaza, as the overall death toll from the onslaught surpasses 30,000. Palestinian resistance fighters inflict more losses on invading Israeli forces in Gaza as fighting on the ground rages on. And Iran successfully launches yet another domestically built research satellite into space. This is News. Thanks for joining us. The scenes of horrific killing of Palestinians have become common ever since the Israeli regime launched its genocidal war on the Gaza Strip. The regime's forces have massacred scores more Gazans who were waiting for humanitarian aid in Gaza City. According to the Palestinian Health Ministry, 77 people were killed after Israeli snipers shot directly at a crowd waiting for aid in the early morning. Hundreds more sustained injuries. The dead and wounded have been taken to Al-Shifa and Kamal Adwan hospitals. The Palestinian Foreign Ministry has condemned the attack, saying that it was a cold-blooded massacre. Palestinian resistance movements Hamas and the Islamic Jihad have also censured the massacre of Gazans. Palestinians are already struggling with shortages of food, as the Israeli regime is using starvation as a weapon against them. Shortages have caused a surge in malnutrition among children, with the UN warning of a looming famine. The Israeli genocide has so far killed over 30,000 Gazans. The U.S.-managed Israeli genocidal war continues to take innocent lives and leave a trail of destruction in the Gaza Strip. Israel's bombing and shelling campaign since October the 7th has turned a large part of Gaza into rubble. Spokesman for the Gaza Health Ministry gives details about the catastrophic situation in the besieged territory.
The estimated casualties of the Israeli aggression stand at approximately 30,000 martyrs and over 70,500 injuries. This points to a systematic policy by the Israeli occupation of committing genocide in the Gaza Strip. Furthermore, this aligns with reports indicating the disappearance of 10,000 individuals. 70% of these martyrs are children and women, in addition to nearly 10% of the martyrs being elderly. Therefore, the Israeli occupation is carrying out a clear process of executing families. There are thousands.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.